You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, star U.S. gymnast Simone Biles pulled out of key Olympic events this week in part because of a psychological concern that could have put her in physical danger. We'll hear more about that decision, and then a sports psychologist joins the show with lessons for all of us. Now, what can an employer do to make sure that their employees feel respected? What if that employer is a professional football team and that employee is their star quarterback? Aaron Rodgers is back with the Packers, but it's not a cozy relationship. Rodgers says it's not just about money, it's about feeling respected for the work he's done and valuing his input. That's something that maybe a lot of people can relate to on the job. We're taking a look at what makes people feel good at the workplace, apart from the money, from the Packers to your place of work. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a job that you've had where you feel like you were listened to by your employer, or one where you weren't? Does it make a difference in your workplace happiness if you're listened to or not? And did the pandemic change the way you think about what matters at work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll talk to a Wisconsin business professor in just a few minutes. We'll start, though, with a look at the Aaron Rodgers story. Ryan Wood is a Packers reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette and PackersNews.com. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, good to be here.
Let's take a listen to some of what Rodgers had to say at the top of a press conference this week. Got a lot of attention when asked about what happened in the offseason with this long-running saga and what had been frustrating him about the Packers organization.
And I just expressed, you know, my desire to be more involved in conversations that directly affected my job. I wanted to help the organization maybe learn from them some of the mistakes in the past, in my opinion, about the way that some of the outgoing veterans were treated, and just the fact that we didn't retain a number of players that I felt like were core players to our foundation, our locker room, high-character guys.
You've been following this story, of course, Ryan, for quite a while now. What were some of your thoughts on what Rodgers had to say there?
Well, it's clear that he feels that he has more to bring to the table than what he's been invited to bring to the table so far. And, you know, whatever you feel about your opinions on whether he feels like he's overstepping or what he wants is overstepping or not, there's no question that he's given a lot of thought to where his assets can best be used. And that's what he wants to do. So I thought he articulated kind of his standpoint as thoroughly with as much clarity as you could possibly hope for, and kind of just put it in the court of public opinion.
A lot of times, Ryan, when we look at pro sports and conflicts over contracts, it's often about the money. We think it's all about the money. How often do we hear stories like this where it's about, respect and concerns over whether, you know, you're valued as a human being?
You know, that's a great point, because you're right. In pro sports, it usually does come down to the money. And Aaron Rodgers has made this clear that it's not about the money at all, right? I mean, he's still getting paid. Mm-hmm. But it's really not about the money. The Packers offered a two-year extension that would have been historic, would have made him the highest-paid player in the league this offseason, and he turned it down because he was doubling down on the idea that it's not about the money. What is this about? It really is about his word was involvement. But it's really about power. It's a power struggle within the hierarchy of the Green Bay Packers and how decisions are made and how influences are dispersed throughout the organization. And it's really a break from the norm. You usually see money struggles. Those are common. Power struggles like this, much less common.
There are two, extreme responses, and I think a lot of people are somewhere on the continuum. On the one hand, people could look at this and say, okay, there's this prima donna athlete who isn't staying in his lane and wants to stick his nose into contract decisions that aren't part of his job, to, hey, this guy's meant a lot to this organization. Why wouldn't they take his thoughts into account, given what he's contributed to the team? What are you seeing? Are you seeing the reaction going one way or another in those two camps?
Oh, I think you got it right. It's pretty evenly split. I think what's fascinating about this is, if you know anything about the history of the Green Bay Packers, and this dates back to when Ron Wolf became the GM in the beginning of the 1990s. So this goes back 30 years. For three decades now, there has been a football czar placed in that GM chair, an unquestioned unchallenged at times leader of the 90-man roster in the offseason, the 53-man roster in the regular season, that does not get strong-armed out of making his decisions for the roster. That has been with Ron Wolf, with Ted Thompson, and until now with Brian Gutekunst. That has been the way the Packers operate. This is a direct challenge to that. And in fact, we did see for the first time a break from that precedent when the Packers executed a trade for Randall Cobb that Brian Gutekunst said he would not have made if not for making Aaron Rodgers happy. This is Aaron Rodgers' trade. It's not Brian Gutekunst's trade. The question going forward is how much that will continue. Brian Gutekunst called it a unique circumstance. Is this a one-off? Is this a welcome back present to Aaron Rodgers? Welcome back. Here's a gift. It's Randall Cobb. Or is this going to be a new day in how decisions are made? That's the thing to really keep an eye on going forward.
Talking to Ryan Wood, Packers reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette and PackersNews.com. Looking at the Aaron Rodgers situation, wider issues too of respect for employees, how employees are treated in the workplace. We're going to be talking to a business professor in just a few minutes about that. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is it important to you to be listened to and feel like you're valued, your opinion is valued at the workplace, whether you're a Green Bay Packer or not? Odds are not, I guess. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Ryan, Aaron Rodgers now is practicing with the team. You're looking at training camp now. Do things feel weird that we're coming out of this high-profile dispute?
The thing that feels weird is how not weird it feels, if that makes any sense. You know, if for 3 months, if you would have wondered what the start of training camp would look like, I think you'd come up with a lot of different ideas. But everything out there looks normal. Aaron Rodgers is wearing that red number 12 jersey, that no-touch jersey that quarterbacks wear for bragging. He's worn for 15 years, 16 years now. And he's taken all the first-team reps. He's the center of attention on the practice field the way he's always been. The weird part of this is how quickly everything kind of went back to normal. But there's also the, you know, what makes this a bit surreal is the Packers have bought themselves a year now, the 2021 season, with Aaron Rodgers back as being contenders, but they've also kicked the can down the road. And this is something they're going to have to return to next spring. They're going to either have to trade him or extend him. So they've kind of delayed this conversation a little bit. But in the meantime, everyone seems like they're very, very much pleased to just kind of focus on the now and appreciate this potential one last run at a Super Bowl.
Ryan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Anytime. Take care.
That's Ryan Wood. He covers the Packers for the Green Bay Press Gazette and PackersNews.com. We talked to him about a candid Aaron Rodgers press conference that raised a number of interesting questions about labor relations that we'll continue to explore coming up. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Most of us are not professional football players, but these issues come up in most any workplace. How important is it to you, if you're an employee, that your management, whatever that looks like, listens to you, values your opinion? And if you manage other people, how do you try to do that? How do you try to listen to the people who work for you, take their needs and wants into account? How important is that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about how we respect and appreciate employees, an ongoing saga, a drama with Aaron Rodgers and the Packers, but it's the kind of thing that could happen in any workplace. Do workers feel respected and listened to? How important is that? You could join in with your thoughts on that very topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Schaefer is an associate professor of economics and director of the Center for Business and Economic Analysis just down the street from Lambeau Field at St. Norbert College's Donald J. Schneider School of Business and Economics. Well, a little further than just down the street. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, happy to be here.
Well, we've been talking about Aaron Rodgers, but these are situations that can come up in any workplace. As you look at this situation, what does it make you think about in terms of, you know, not just the dollars and cents relationship between boss and worker, but I don't know, that idea of respect and listening to employees?
You know, I think you're kind of hitting it right on the head. I think from a firm perspective, firms really want employees to be engaged. They want them to be engaged in the mission, engaged in the objective of what that firm is trying to do. And the flip side of that is, I think, to get that engagement, employees need to feel valued. They need to have trust in leadership. They have to feel supported by the management. It has to be a positive working environment, opportunities for growth. All of those things are going to play into this conversation. And I think that's coming out a little bit in the press conference, is that feeling of wanting to be valued is an important aspect that I think a lot of us seek for any of our employment opportunities in our jobs. And I think a great example of that, maybe to sort of focus on the pandemic, for example, you know, prior to the pandemic, remote work was kind of few and far between. I think I saw a statistic that said about 5% of work days were basically remote work prior to the pandemic. And obviously, it increased a lot during the pandemic. And one of the things that was a surprising statistic that I saw in a consulting report was that after, this was maybe, let's say, January of this year, about 88% of employees felt like their productivity in the remote work environment either stayed the same or increased. And shockingly, employers actually, about 84% agreed in the same way. And I think that hits on the idea that trust is an important thing. And that remote work thing is a very much a trust issue. So I think this is something that is playing out generally in the workplace, but maybe even more so as we sort of are moving through this pandemic and what the future holds for the workplace environment.
On the flip side, if I'm running an organization, I may value this employee, my quarterback or my counter clerk or whatever it might be. But I know things that they don't, and I am managing a big picture, and I don't want them to go too far out of their lane and think they run the place. How do we split the difference there?
You know, I don't know if I have the magic bullet or the perfect answer to that question, because that's a great question. I mean, I think that gets to back to sort of that trust in the leadership and supportive management. I mean, because you're exactly right. I mean, you have a star employee, for example, that's doing everything really well, very successful, turning in good numbers or whatever the context of that job is. But again, they're not privy to the big picture, for example. And I think that's kind of where the trust piece is really the critical component to sort of blending the gap between those two things.
Now, you mentioned the pandemic that has shaken up, obviously, workplaces a lot. It opened the door, as you just mentioned, to remote working. Are there other things that you think are changing in the employer-employee relationship as all this goes on?
You know, I think maybe one important thing, and this is maybe a contextual thing, that might tie a little bit to some of the comments that Rogers had made. You know, there's a little bit of a piece here about like leverage. So, for example, suppose, you know, I'm doing really well and I want to go to my boss and say, you know, I think I'm doing good. I think I deserve a raise. And there's a whole conversation to be had there. And I think what's interesting right now in our current labor market, and I'm a macroeconomist by training, so I spend a good amount of time looking at labor markets. You know, if you actually compare, and this is maybe a comparison that some of our listeners are going to be familiar with, is if you think back to the financial crisis, 2007, we had a period of high unemployment. And just like our current environment, we have this period of high unemployment that's sort of starting to come down. But what's interesting, and Rob, I apologize if you lose any listeners from me talking like an economist here for a second, but you know, in the financial crisis, we had a situation where we actually had a lot of workers. We had a high labor supply, but there weren't enough jobs to really go around. Whereas the situation we have right now is almost the exact opposite, where we actually have a lot of firms are like looking for workers, but there's not enough workers coming in to fill those positions. And the reason why I think that's an important thing to note is that basically gets to kind of who's a little bit more in the driver's seat. So in the financial crisis type period, you basically had the firms were in the driver's seat, right? Workers were just, we want a job. So firms could actually, you know, be a little bit more strong arm with lower wages or things like that, potentially in that environment. Whereas in our current environment, we have a situation where I think you're seeing all kinds of incentives happening to get workers to come work in certain jobs and in certain sectors. And I think that's really important when you think about the concept of this leverage component, because you might even have a lot of workers who are working right now and they're looking at, well, what are the benefits I'm getting now in the post-COVID environment? We were remote work. Is that going to continue? Do we get one day? Do we get 2 days? Is that gone? And they're looking for all these extra benefits now. But they also know, hey, now might be a decent time that I can shop around for maybe a job that might give me more of those benefits that I want if my current employer is not giving them to me. I think that's where you're kind of seeing an interesting change in the environment right now, because it's a tight labor market where you're kind of seeing the workers have a little bit more power here, only because the firms need the workers and there's just not enough of them coming in to fill these jobs. And to be clear, that's in certain sectors, not all sectors across the board.
We're talking to Mark Schaefer from St. Norbert College, professor, associate professor of economics there. We are looking about respect at the workplace. Do you, as an employee, feel respected by your organization, by your manager? Prompted in part by Aaron Rodgers, you know, the Green Bay Packers guy, saying he's getting paid fine, doesn't feel respected or valued in some ways by management. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been an issue for better or worse for you at work as an employee and employer? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Megan in Madison who called in, couldn't stay on the line. Megan says it's really important for her that her boss take her opinions into consideration. She said she had a boss who wasn't interested in, at all in what she had to say, and it was so bad she actually quit. So, Mark, how important do you think this kind of thing can be for employee retention?
I mean, I think it's absolutely huge. I mean, the crux of our entire conversation has been, you know, do you as an employee feel valued? And that listener's comment right there, I think, hits that exactly on the head. I mean, if you have thoughts and opinions, now, to be fair, management's not always going to take them, and management's not always, you know, the bad guy or something like that in this conversation, of course. But I do think that feeling like you're being heard is an important part of feeling valued. And if you're not being heard, then you're obviously not going to feel that value. And I think part of that also aligns to, you want to know you have a future in your current environment, your current workplace, right? And if you feel like everything you're suggesting and saying is falling on deaf ears, you know, you're going to have employees that feel like, well, maybe there's a place that I can grow. That's a much better environment for me to thrive in.
You confessed already to being an economist, Mark. I wonder, does the field of economics take these kind of intangibles into consideration? I mean, I know we think about the dollars and cents and maybe the benefits and what they value. Is it possible to study these things and take into account these intangibles like respect and how you're treated at a workplace?
I mean, I think if you really want to lose a lot of listeners, Rob, we could go into some journal article conversations about this topic. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there's a whole field of labor economics that looks at a lot of these types of questions. And this is also blending into management and human resource research and things of that nature. There's many studies that look at what are all these other benefit factors that seem to be extremely important. This is just some survey stuff recently from the Deloitte consulting firm. They were actually surveying employees and companies about a host of different things. And one of the things that came out, just as an example of something that's important to workers and apparently now executives too, is the opportunity for upskilling, training, growing as sort of in your profession, in your field. I saw statistics that 90% of companies believe this is an important thing moving forward, is that upskilling be a required thing for employees, giving them the time to actually grow and develop in that way. So that's like a recent touch point of some research that basically said this is a new thing that is an extremely important topic moving forward. So that's one sort of example of something that might come to light in that context.
Do you think more companies are going to embrace things like that, the flexibility to allow some work at home, more flexible hours where that's possible? Are companies going to be embracing these kind of things more?
You know, I think there's going to be an interesting dynamic across, and again, there's going to be different industries that we're talking about. We're talking about remote work, because some industries that just doesn't obviously make sense for, let's say, hospitality and services sector, for example. But I do think moving forward, this is a huge conversation. As I mentioned, and not to make the entire conversation about remote work, but, you know, prior to this, I mentioned about 5% of jobs were kind of work from home structured. Some recent research out of the University of Chicago has suggested, you know, moving forward, sort of post pandemic, and you know, there's obviously where we are on that right now is a different conversation. But post pandemic, they're suggesting, estimating at least 20% of all full workdays will take place in a work from home environment moving forward. And I think part of that gets to the comments I made earlier about the tight labor market. I think you have a lot of employees that said, "Hey, look, I did remote work and it worked. We were productive." Now, are you going to allow us to still do some of that? And if you're not, that's fine. But I might take this opportunity now to shop around. I think that's going to be a pressure that's going to be put on a lot of firms right now, figuring out how to manage this moving forward. And I think that's a huge question for firms right now. And it's a huge challenge.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sorry, I'm going to jump in. We've got Lou on the line in northern Wisconsin. Lou, hi.
Hey, guys. Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about, Lou?
That I work for a great company. Pathways Transport. And they are actually a, kind of a two-sided, very small, small local business. They have CARES and transport. And they know that with my past experience of home care nurse, that they can put me on both sides. And they always respect the fact that, you know, they always ask first. I tell them, don't ask, just tell me what you want me to do. You know, I'm your worker. I'm here for you. But they always say, hey, you know, we've got to put you on the care side, or we're going to have you just driving this week or whatever. You know, and they do consider, I will speak for myself, they do consider the employer or the employee, and, you know, they ask and take into account, you know, things that are going on with your family. They're very... very personable that way.
And it sounds like that's worth something to you, Lou.
It is. Even through the pandemic, they were just very, very good about watching out for our safety.
Lou, thanks a lot for that call. Mark, just in our last few moments, your thoughts on what Lou said, and it seems like she likes that working place for that reason.
You know, I think Lou's comment is a great way to sort of end the conversation here. And that is, I think, you know, especially if you look at the pandemic situation, there's a lot of firms out there that really did an amazing job taking care of their employees, trying to be flexible, trying to help them in that way. And I think that's a great way to sort of end the conversation is, you know, this is a two-sided thing. There's, you know, there's an employee perspective and employer perspective. And I think, you know, the more that those two parties obviously can work together and build that trust, the better we're going to be.
Lou, thanks for that call. And Mark, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Mark Schaefer is Associate Professor of Economics at the St. Norbert College Donald J. Schneider School of Business and Economics. We talked to him about the changing ways employers are trying to show respect and appreciation for employees, including non-monetary ways, inspired by some comments about the Packers by returning quarterback Aaron Rodgers. American Olympic gymnast Simone Biles, who Sports Illustrated and many others have referred to as the greatest gymnast of all time, made headlines the last few days for withdrawing from the all-around competition. I want to take a listen to what she had to say to the media after withdrawing from the finals.
Yeah, I say put mental health first, because if you don't, then you're not going to enjoy your sport and you're not going to succeed as much as you want to. So it's okay sometimes to even sit out the big competitions to focus on yourself, because it shows how strong of a competitor and person that you really are, rather than just battle through it.
Biles hadn't lost a major competition since her debut in 2013, winning her sixth Olympic medal of her career in Tokyo, winning 19 world championships along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In just a bit, we're going to talk to a sports psychologist. If you've ever participated in sports, have you dealt with a significant mental block? Have you felt like your mind got in the way of what your body could actually do? You knew it could do it. Did you ever have an injury or close call that prevented you from getting back out there, at least right away? Call in at 800-642-1234. Now, Liz Clark joins us, sports writer for The Washington Post for more than 20 years, covering 9 Olympic Games. Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, I'm delighted. I'm so glad you're talking about this important topic. Glad to be with you.
I want to give a listen to Simone Biles. This was before the Olympics, talking to Sports Illustrated. Here's a listen.
It feels like work, but I choose to do it, so it's definitely fun. But then, of course, as I get older, the worries start to set in, like, okay, I'm in the air. If something goes wrong, like, I'm really going to hurt myself.
And that's, that concern right there, it seems like it's at the center of the story. Can you talk about the specific concern that Biles was having about her performance and the so-called twisties, and why this was such a physical concern?
I'd love to, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, and the two terms that she used might have sent some listeners in a wrong direction. So she described herself, as you said, as having the twisties, and that she also said she was kind of in the wrong headspace. But what she's alluding to is a state in gymnastics, despite the sort of fanciful sound of the word twisty, it's extremely serious, where in the air, and she, all of her routines involve flips and twists, multiple flips and twists, many with blind landings where you cannot see the ground before you land, which is highly, highly dangerous. So in the twisties, you lose your body awareness. She's in space flipping, and she truly doesn't know if she's up or down. And an athlete must have rely on total confidence that they know where they are and rely on muscle memory to get them where they need to be. And both of those things deserted her. And we saw that quite literally with her first vault in the team event, where midair she walked it back basically and left out a flip and did not land steadily, kind of did a roll and went immediately off the map. So what she's risking if she were to continue competing in this manner is not just a bad score or an embarrassing performance. It could be a catastrophic injury. It could be a spinal cord injury. It could be catastrophic leg injury that ends her career. The analogy is really to, I think, a 747 pilot showing up for duty with double vision or vertigo and making the decision, it is not safe for me to fly this plane. I need to stand down. That's the scale of the stakes, of the fear, and the reality she faced there on the Olympic floor, which was just tragic.
I'm not a gymnast with good reason, and I've been struggling to come up with analogies. Your plane one is a great one. I think, in, you know, if I were out driving and I suddenly lost my depth perception and I can't tell if that car is 2 feet or 10 feet from me, I'd get off the road. And that's basically what Simone Biles did here, right?
Yes, and she did so for two reasons. A, her own safety. I mean, being slightly off on a double Pike Yurchenko vault or a triple double flip that she, you know, was planning to do, being slightly off again could be a spinal cord injury. So she needed to keep herself safe, but she also, there was a selfless component. She needed to stop because she knew her scores weren't going to be close to good enough, and that in a team event would cost her teammates the medal too, that the best she could do was not good enough, and she needed her teammates to take over and drive, as to use your analogy.
We're talking to sports writer Liz Clark with the Washington Post, looking at Simone Biles, the Olympics, her decision to withdraw from events, facing the twisties, as gymnasts call it, and deciding not to risk her well-being or her teammates' scores, as you just heard there. Liz, can you talk more about this concept? I guess it's a common thing among gymnasts. They do these incredible, amazing, and in my mind, incredibly dangerous things again and again. What is it about this that they suddenly lose that awareness of where the ground is, where the ground is going to hit them?
I mean, I was not a competitive gymnast. But we have a former competitive gymnast who is in Tokyo and doing the bulk of the coverage on Simone, who I've covered for 5 years. So I've learned a lot from my coworker Emily Jambavo's coverage. And elite gymnasts know this term, the twisties. I think it's new for even a lot of reporters because we, you know, gymnasts don't take the gym floor if they have them. You don't really see them seize a gymnast in the middle of competition. So it's known kind of among elite athletes, but maybe not commonly known. And one thing we all have come to know about Simone Biles is not only that she has redefined the limits of her sport, but she is one of the most mentally tough athletes I have ever covered. And I've covered 8 years of the NFL. I've covered, you know, World Cups. I've covered tons of sports. Pound for pound, she is mentally fierce. So this is not something you can control as a matter of will or desire or toughness. You can't gut out the twisties. You know, it's sort of like vertigo. It's out of your control. As far as what triggers it, I think some believe that stress, extreme stress, triggers it. She's certainly been under enormous stress that she shouldered so bravely. We don't realize that. Just like she makes her stunts look so easy, we don't realize that she's, yay, so close to a catastrophic injury every time she does one of these extreme stunts. So, you know, the 1 year delay in these Olympics was an incredible ask for a 23-year-old gymnast who's now 24. If you were a 15-year-old female gymnast, you'd love that extra year. Like, I'm going to get better. I'm going to get stronger. I'll be age eligible. I can compete. So this 1 year delay cut two ways. It helped some athletes. It really hurt others. Simone showed no sign that it hurt her, but it took a terrible toll to tell a 23-year-old female gymnast, you're at your peak now, but just keep peaking for a whole nother year, and we'll get you to an Olympics. And that is a lot. We haven't even talked about the lawsuit that she is engaged in, along with hundreds of others, with USA Gymnastics, for whom she is competing. So, you know, she is at odds legally with USA Gymnastics and the USOPC, the US Olympic Committee.
I wanted to get your thoughts on that, Liz. You drew our producer's attention to that. Not only, I mean, being on this world stage, this Olympics event, sounds really stressful to me. On top of that, she's been through the abuse and the kind of cover up and poor handling of that abuse from the organization she's representing on this world stage. Can you talk about that as a factor, an additional source of stress?
Yes, and I recognize that for many, many listeners and many people who follow the Olympics, it's understandable that we want to believe the Nassar chapter is over. The serial molester of hundreds of female gymnasts, he is in jail. He will never get out of jail. So that has been adjudicated. That is over. That's only partially true. For the victims, it's not at all over, because they want those culpable, those complicit, they want those who enabled their abuse to happen to be held accountable. And that has not happened. The former head of USA Gymnastics, who was given evidence that Larry Nassar was molesting female gymnasts, he did not report it. He did not act. And on down the line, there was a scathing report that just came out from the FBI about its own agents mishandling of what happened. So there's still key players that enable this abuse that have not had any consequences happen to them. So gymnast Simone Biles, among them, are in a lawsuit against USA Gymnastics and seeking information that they're being denied. And so the fight is not over for them. Yet for Simone, it's just an impossible box this leaves her in. And she has not articulated it in these words. So this is my analysis. I want to be clear. She is tasked with competing for USA Gymnastics, which raises money, gets sponsors based on her success. And they're bankrupt because of Nassar, but they're trying to get out of bankruptcy. So Simone Biles is their biggest star. So her success, what she achieves at the Olympics, it helps USA Gymnastics get out of debt. It also helps them fund the lawsuits that are trying to keep information, from victims. So I just can only imagine. I don't think any of us can imagine how you compartmentalize. I think that's a good word that high-performing athletes use a lot. I need to control what I can control. Don't worry about the weather. Don't worry about this or that. Just like swim in my lane, do my thing, compartmentalize. And that's a great tactic for all successful athletes. But I just don't know how you compartmentalize this when it comes to abuse and feeling like you haven't had closure and still compete at your best. So that's just part of the psychological burden Simone has been bearing.
Liz, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Liz Clark, sports writer at the Washington Post, talking about Simone Biles and her decision to withdraw from Olympic events. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin sports psychologist, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you compete or have competed in sports, how do you deal with the mental side of your sport? Have you had that block, whether you're a gymnast and it's the twisties, or a baseball player and it's the yips, or whatever name your sport calls it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation. We talk now to Alan Chu, assistant professor and chair of the Sport, Exercise, and Performance Psychology Program at UW Green Bay. We just heard about Simone Biles and some of the factors that led to her decision to withdraw from Olympic events, especially this so-called twisties, this very dangerous situation, a kind of a mental block in the air that lets you not know when and where you're going to land. We're going to talk about that now and more general issues for athletes at all levels. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Alan, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me.
When you are talking to an athlete who has that block, whether it's the twisties in gymnastics or, you know, the batter doesn't know how to hit anymore, they lose that skill for the moment that they've had and developed over the years. What are some of the starting points? How can they start to work through that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So normally when we work with athletes, we will need to understand what they are thinking and feeling in the moment. So the first thing that we usually ask them to do is just to get in touch with how they feel and what they think. Are they feeling nervous? Are they thinking about their opponents? Are they thinking about they are not having enough confidence to win? So after knowing the why, the causes of how they lose their skill, that's how we assess some of the strategies to work with them. A lot of time, it will take some routine, such as taking a deep breath, using some positive self-talk, such as, I got this, let's go. Or if they want to get more energy, explode, could be a self-talk word that they use. Or if they want to get more calm, you know, they can say to themselves, relax, take it slow. So I think we need to really find out first, what are the causes of that mental block? And then based on that, we'll use different strategy to help athletes use their routine and different psychological strategy to help them in the moment. But even though I say that it's in the moment, those are the practices that athletes need to engage every single day at practice. It's not just one day or 2 days before competition. It's something that we work with them daily, regularly, so that they have practices just like physically. You know, they go to the gym, lifting weight, doing different routine and drills, same for the psychological routine and psychological strategies as well.
Now, most of us are not athletes on the level of a Simone Biles. That said, can this happen to anyone at kind of any level of competition where they get whatever that sport's form of a mental block is?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of time when we talk about that mental block is related to thinking too much, overthinking. When we are already good at something, we normally do not need to think about it. We just execute automatically. You know, even normal people, if I ask you to drive, you probably just drive without thinking about it. But if I ask you to describe to me how you drive and do the driving at the same time, it actually may mess up how you drive and it will feel awkward. Or same as if you need to do a typing, type on a keyboard, you normally just type automatically. You wouldn't need to think about where each key is because you're so skilled at typing. And transferring that to sport in high school level, collegiate level, in a normal setting, you just execute your skills. However, for any athlete who have not gotten psychological skill training, it's very common for them to get nervous before the big game, even just the sectional tournament or state tournament or national tournament. It's very common, especially in a setting that they are not very familiar, which is something that we see a lot at the Olympics. But I would say that across different level, whenever you are in an uncertain setting, it's very common that you overthink and you get nervous. And then if you don't practice enough, you will not be able to deliver at your best. Even thinking about any performance, if you have to deliver a presentation to 1,000 people, if you never done that before, you have not practiced how to keep yourself calm, likely you'll feel really nervous and you would maybe thinking that, oh, people are judging me or I'm not doing well. You're just overthinking about other factors that are not related to your performance and end up cannot execute automatically.
Now, thinking about younger athletes, Alan, do you have thoughts for their coaches and maybe their parents to make sure that that kids aren't feeling negative effects from stress going into the game, big game or small game?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I had that experience as an athlete myself and as a coach also. I would say that also playing into the uncertainty factor that I mentioned, try to interact with athlete the same way as how you would as a coach or parent during practices, meaning that you are not trying to shout or yell more than usual. You keep the same energy level when you interact. But more importantly, I think we need to respect adolescents to ask them, hey, I know you have a tournament or you have a match tomorrow. How would you like me to perform on the sideline? Would you like me to support you? And there's something very interesting that based on the personality is very different. You know, I'm a more extroverted person and I'm a little bit high energy person. When I go out and play table tennis, my sport, you know, I love that my teammate, my coach, people cheer me up very loud. But I also know some teammates who are more introverted, who like low intensity. They would rather no one say anything. They just want to be quiet and just be in their own head, own mindset going into the match. So I think really importantly, parents and coaches need to understand each one is individual and the athlete that they work with, how they want us to do to support them at the tournament, at the match would be best. And also keeping it consistent rather than if it's a big game, you know, I'm going to be more engaged as a parent. You know, we shouldn't do that. We should stay somewhat consistent so that athletes are familiar with all the external factors playing into the match.
And Alan, we know Simone Biles pulled herself from competition in part because she was in physical danger because of this mental block. For athletes who are having some kind of a mental or emotional challenge related to the game, when do you think it's time to say, okay, you know what, we need to sit out a game or two and get things back together?
Yeah, this is a really individual consideration. I think athletes may not have realized that if they have not been a big tournament or be on a big game. So all I would normally say is that, you know, Simone Biles, she was quite obvious based on what she said. You know, she was saying that this was mental, but it was a very physical reaction. So in psychology, we talk about anxiety having two different components. One is the cognitive component, meaning that it's your own thoughts. You are thinking that you are nervous, not confident. You think you will mess up. You know, that's just the thinking itself. But that's the somatic or physiological responses that are associated with that anxiety or that mental block, meaning that you physically have so much muscle tension or you have lost your awareness that you can't even execute a skills. So I would say that if an athlete realized that in that match, in that game, the reaction that they have is not just their thought, but it's actually playing out into their behavior, their physiological responses, then that may be a time to call it a timeout, call a stop, reassess to see whether it's worth continuing.
Alan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you again for having me.
Alan Chu is an assistant professor and chair of the Sport, Exercise, and Performance Psychology Program at UW Green Bay. He's a certified mental performance consultant and is on the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee Sports Psychology and Mental Training Registry. We talked to him about the mental component of athletic competition.